Hello everyone and welcome to the CoinPass podcast. I am your host Jeff Hancock and what we talk about here is crypto, blockchain, fintech and investing. And today we've got a very, very special guest is Charles Adams from the Zero Carbon Project. And Zero Carbon Project is taking climate change by rewarding customers for switching to zero carbon energy. The zero carbon market beats renewable energy and fossil fuels on price and customers are rewarded with a stake in the success of the Zero Carbon Project. Charles, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. It's great to be here. So I'm Charles, I'm from the Zero Carbon Project, and I'm sure we'll have a great discussion.
So what we're talking about today is the future of cryptocurrencies and crypto mining, and it's a little bit of a loaded topic. You know, when we talk about crypto mining, you know, two names come to mind is Bitcoin and Ethereum. You know, specifically when a lot of people kind of get involved in crypto or they start reading about it, they talk about tokens. And tokens, where they can be sent, where they can be spent, how they can be traded, how they can make money, you know, what is this actually delivering as a use case. But I suppose what a lot of people forget until you get down into the, you know, really down into the nitty gritty and into the tech level of how these, you know, decentralized blockchain protocols actually work. And they're either based on one of two things. They're your proof of stake model or they're a proof of work model. And I suppose, Charles, just for the audience who's probably never, you know, gotten into this kind of level before, give us a little bit of a brief of both. What are the merits and kind of, you know, where do you see, you know, the market kind of going in terms of decentralized protocols?
So proof of work is, you know, you maintain the network by effectively buying these Bitcoin miners. You invest in mining equipment and in return for maintaining the network, you get rewarded for that. And proof of stake takes a slightly different turn on it. Instead of investing in mining equipment, you have to invest in the coin, the token, the currency directly. And you stake that, proving that you have a vested interest in that currency, and you maintain the network through setting up a node or using a staking as a service to do such. And I think, you know, the core difference if you're an operator of this mining equipment or you're looking to start staking a currency, is the cost. So a mining rig, you know, so let's say you spend £10,000 on it, you know that if you spend a year mining a currency, you can still sell that equipment on for you know, maybe £8,000, £6,000. Whereas with proof of stake, it's the value of that currency you've bought. If you've bought Ether, you know, 32 ETH is going to be required on Ether 2.0 to stake. The value of Ether goes up by 50%. You haven't had to lay out all this money on mining equipment, which isn't a depreciating asset. But on the other hand, if the value of the currency goes down by 90%, you don't have the equipment to be able to restore some of your, to get some cash back in. And I think, you know, the big difference between the two in terms of the media is energy. Proof of work needs all this energy. Some say, you know, it uses more than Switzerland. But, you know, you mentioned Ethereum and Bitcoin first, and I think, when you look at these two, Ethereum uses 10% roughly of the energy Bitcoin does per transaction. And I think, you know, when you break this apart, the reason why this move is happening from proof of work to proof of stake is scalability. A lot of people in the media, they focus all on energy, but it's actually happening because of scalability. And I think that misconception is actually a good thing. One of the fundamental beliefs about blockchain is that you need economic incentives to be aligned for long-term change to actually happen and to stick. So the fact that these interests are aligned, I'm sure we'll delve into some more detail later, but it's fantastic to see that, you know, in order for these blockchains to become more scalable, they're going to have to become more environmentally friendly as well.
And I suppose when we talk about environmentally friendliness, you know, that's probably one of the big parts and one of the big, you know, detractors, I suppose, from, you know, the traditional investors, traditional financial markets wanting to, you know, poke, you know, at the Bitcoin blockchain or the Ethereum blockchain and all these other kind of new ideas out there. And some of them are still throttled and kind of held back by their transaction speed. You know, you get, you know, something that's, you know, brand new and prototype, you know, like the Bitcoin network, and they compare it to something that's hugely established and fast, you know, like the Visa network. And I remember having these kind of conversations a few years ago where people were, you know, when are we going to have a blockchain that matches or exceeds Visa and MasterCard? And my answer was when Visa and MasterCard build their own blockchain and kind of come into the market and join the rest of us on the moon. So, I mean, when we talk about, you know, harmfulness to the environment and, you know, the scalability of some of these chains, you know, instantly people want to think, you know, it has to be linear. if we do this much with this kind of token and this kind of blockchain now, to get it up to here, we have to just dial up the power instead of dial up the innovation. How is crypto mining, I suppose, now actually measured as being harmful to the environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there are definitely two camps. People that CoinShares produced this big report, 74% of energy which is used for mining comes from renewable sources. And when you first hear that statistic, most people go, no way, that's not true. But when you actually break it down and think, what does a miner want? A miner wants cheap energy, really, really cheap energy, the cheapest possible. And the cheapest possible energy in the world comes from renewable sources. If you're burning coal to produce energy and no one wants that energy, you stop burning coal. If you've got a hydroelectric dam and the water is flowing down it, but no one wants energy, where does it go? Batteries are coming on, but they're not effective enough to be able to store, all the energy from the Three Gorges Dam and then be able to effectively transport it across China. And this was something that, especially China built all these hydroelectric dams. 50% of China's energy is renewable. Whether the hydroelectric dams are environmentally friendly is a whole other discussion, but they're built. And they were built with the premise that once they were built, this energy would be able to be effectively transported across China. And that hasn't come to fruition. Their best answer has been actually to transport the water and then generate energy from the water. But so we've got these dams and they're producing energy. And I think, if that was going to go to a house, to power, their normal everyday essentials, and instead a Bitcoin miner came along and said, I'm going to take that energy. So the house ends up having to go back to fossil fuels. The opportunity cost is quite clear there. The miner's doing some harm, even though they're on renewable energy. But if that energy is going to get thrown away, Bitcoin is, or Ethereum mining are fantastic opportunities. These people actually get to generate revenue from their energy, as well as providing a business for someone else, as well as an avenue for making money. And the people on the other side of the camp is the University of Cambridge with the Joules report. They have the dashboard, which is most commonly cited, that has Bitcoin's energy usage in kilowatt hours against countries, which I think is clearly not the most unbiased way of presenting it. But there's one thing that both of the reports agree on, and that's these big excess areas that produce all this excess energy. The north of China with all these hydroelectric dams, the north coast of Germany when it's windy season, they have phenomenal offshore wind turbines, wind farms there, and they produce the most, they have a lot of excess energy during the winter season. And that's why you see these shipping containers with loads of mining rigs stuffed in there, a satellite dish plonked on the top. It's because it's they make more money by moving them around to these places and offering these wind farms, these hydroelectric dams, penny on the pound spare energy. And I think that, you may look at it and think, oh, it uses more energy than Switzerland, that's awful. But when you think that this energy was going to get thrown away, or you look at other places, Iceland, geothermal energy. Iceland, if we could transport it, they have enough renewable energy to power the whole of the UK. The issue is that we can't build a wire big enough and efficient enough to transport it all down here. And I think it's a common misconception that actually looks very promising because as mining gets more competitive, people are going to have to find even cheaper energy sources, which is going to push them to find even more nooks and crannies of energy which are currently getting wasted.
Well, you could even say that, this type of innovation, the more that it takes off and the more that it's accepted, is going to spur on, even greater innovation in the renewable energy space. It's going to provide, more competition between providers that are providing, these cleaner and greener energies. And just like you say, it's wasted energy. I mean, flowing water is not going to turn off if it's, a main, a main river, main estuary, etc. The sun is probably not going to turn off, within our lifetime. And we've got all of this, excess solar energy, and Australia is one of the big leaders for that. We've got a lot of space, probably one of the biggest island in the world. There's lots of sun. It gets hot in Australia. That's the understatement of the year. And we've got still, solar farms being built all the time. And it's the calculation there is we've got all this space, but what tech is going to deliver the best, solar to, distribution? And it's like you say, it's how long can we build the cable? How efficient can it be? Can we store all this energy on batteries? And battery tech is kind of almost, you know, one of those one of those solvable innovations that, you know, Elon Musk has put a lot of time and effort into that. He went and built the massive factory down in Australia as well. We've almost got like these, you know, these two big innovation pockets that when they catch up, that renewable energy can literally take over from fossil fuels. But then you've still got these, you know, the industry players that do they want to let go of that control, which is much like we talk about crypto. Do banks and central governments want to give up control, you know? So, I mean, when we come up against this saying that it's harmful, what are they kind of actually measuring that statement against? You know, say it uses more than Switzerland, but Switzerland's, it's not that big of a country. You know, what are they actually using as a yardstick to measure and actually make that poking statement?
Well, they look at the current kilowatt hours that all the Bitcoin miners in the world energy are using, and they use a rough assumption to transport that to carbon emissions. And this is why they've kind of butted heads, maybe for lack of a better term, with the CoinShares report, because they don't factor in that 74% of it is from renewable sources. They don't factor in really any of this, even though they recognize that a lot of it is coming from surplus energy. It's not really factored in into their conclusion. And I also don't think they look towards the future. You know, as I said, they're going to be forced to become more decentralized. So I think that, you know, that's the actual limiting factor of the Jules report and the University of Cambridge is what they're measuring it against. I think they should be taking a much more kind of input and output approach. What are we putting into this Bitcoin and blockchain and proof of work? What are we getting out from it? Mm. And then take Switzerland as a country. Out of all the energy consumption, what do you get from Switzerland? You get some fantastic things from Switzerland, and you get some not so fantastic things from Switzerland. And I think that's very similar with, you know, proof of work. It produces some fantastic results. In many ways, I think the problems of proof of work is it's been too effective. But with proof of work, the amount of energy is directly, you know, linked to how secure it is. If you want it to be more secure, you need more energy. And, you know, that goes back to the aligning incentives. We need to kind of align those incentives back. But it's been too effective. It's too secure. And we look.
Do you think that, you know, when they say what they're measuring against, you know, would it be fair that, you know, Bitcoin as a currency and as a, you know, a decentralized monetary system, you know, with a lot of the statements out there, with the white papers, etc., should, you know, the harmful effect of crypto mining specifically for Bitcoin or Ethereum, should that be compared to what is the energy consumption of the current monetary system? Is that a fair comparison?
It'd be definitely be better. When I worked it out, a transaction on Ethereum uses 10% of Bitcoin. I'd be interested to know what it would be for Visa or MasterCard. Mm. And not just that transaction when you tap your card, but the offices of Visa, the offices of MasterCard. You know, I really think you're going to have to trace this all the way down and look at it as an entire ecosystem. Because that's how they look at the blockchain ecosystem, the blockchain communities as a whole. I think a lot of times we get judged as a whole. And I think actually that's one of the problems is that we don't go there to our crypto meetups and say, oh, I want all this fossil fuel energy for my proof of work miners. I don't want to be using the same energy as Switzerland. I want to be using the same as America. Yeah. I want to be using more energy than America. Mm. That's not what the community wants. The community wants a decentralized financial system. Ethereum's trying to build a supercomputer, a global decentralized supercomputer. And then when you start having that, you know, that discussion of how much energy would it take to power a global decentralized supercomputer? Mm. Would it be worth it? And then you compare it to the energy that, let's say, Visa and MasterCard use. And I think control plays a big aspect of it. Mm. Because we don't actually have control over where Visa and MasterCard get their energy. Whereas if you're a miner or you're supporting a network, you do have some control. Mm. I believe the value of these currencies comes from how many people are using them, how many people know about them, the value that's generated on them. And you get to decide, we get to decide as a project, do we support Ethereum? Do we, you know, have our token on BSV? Mm. Do we have our token on, Cardano or Stellar? Or we get to choose which blockchain project we're going to support. and everyone does. No one's forcing anyone in any directions. And I think, you know, if we fast forward 25 years, the consensus mechanism isn't going to be proof of stake or proof of work. I think it's going to be something else, something more like Dash and Masternodes, something more like delegated proof of stake, where you have these, you know, you're still using some energy, but you're able to have other outputs other than securing the network. So if you're not processing transactions or you're not securing the network, instead of just having a dormant server that's switched on, you can start processing data for, I don't know, an NGO or a charity or something like that. Start doing something that's providing value outside of the ecosystem. And you're already seeing some signs of that. EHR data in Texas is trying to, use the blockchain to solve the opioid problem through increased transparency. And they have, very interesting needs when it comes to a consensus mechanism, because they need to know that a transaction is immutable as quickly as possible. And proof of stake, it takes longer than proof of work. Bitcoin is considered to be 6 blocks, I think, whereas proof of stake, it could be a week. But that comes at the trade-off of it being more scalable. And there'll be some projects where, we can easily wait a month, a week's no issue. But if you're putting health data on the blockchain and someone could be going to the doctors, a week suddenly seems like a very long time.
Exactly. And just one of your key points that I really picked up on, which I thought was great, was choice. When it comes, it boils down to, from the token level to the protocol level to its proof of work, proof of stake, there's an energy consumption there. We can be using our servers and nodes for different things, different purposes, different energy consumption. And we as the business or the consumer can choose where we're going to get our energy from. People are very open to this and very they do this already. Choosing between your energy provider at home, what tariff do you want to be on, who's got the best deal, who's going to reward my business, etc. And you can pick and choose who you want to send your money to. And I suppose with what you guys are doing with Zero Carbon Project, how are you kind of connecting consumers to making more informed decisions around choosing zero carbon energy for their homes and houses?
So essentially we have a switching site, works very much like a comparison website, but we don't send you to different fuzzy energy supplier websites to complete the process. We take care of that. But instead of using a traditional financial system to kind of monitor that progress, we use our token economy. And then if more people use the platform, there's more value being generated by that token economy. And instead of using that surplus value to pour back into coal or put in our back pocket, we use that to reward the people who are actually using clean energy, the people who are actually driving change. And it's an additional incentive. I wish we didn't need to use blockchain. I wish that we could just say, this is the cleanest energy in your country. And people go, fantastic, I'll use that energy. But in reality, even if you promise people cost savings, it's still not enough. 10.5 million people in the UK save £300 or more on their energy. 18.5 million people in the UK could save £200 or more on their energy.
Wow. So that's nearly a third of the population of a country could save more than 200 quid a year using a zero carbon source.
And it's about half of households. Wow. And when you say that, one thing cries out to me, that's a market that's not working. It's a market that's not working efficiently. If people can be saving money and moving to cleaner energy sources, that should be the floodgates are open, everyone's rushing in, but people are like, I don't want to deal with it. It's like mobile phone bills. Vodafone can pay me £5 more. If I don't have to ring them, that's I'll happily pay £5. Whereas, you go back to the blockchain examples, it's a choice. You're not wedged in with these contracts or these fantasy energy suppliers, because that's what I think it comes down to. And when you look at the big six traditional energy suppliers in this country, British Gas is suffering a massive issue at the moment with losing customers. I think that's because they don't want to deal with British Gas. So instead, if they can deal with someone like us, and we'll reward them for doing that, they don't have to come back every year. If in a year's time we can save them money by moving them to a different zero carbon energy source, we'll send them an email, let them know what's happening. They can choose to cancel it, but we'll automatically switch them. People can really move energy to the back of their mind and know that they're always using the cheapest, cleanest energy, and they're getting rewarded for doing so.
And how is zero carbon kind of, we talked about your choice of different blockchains and stuff like that. What are you guys primarily using to kind of deploy your token and deploy your product right now?
So we're primarily using Ethereum. We are big fans of Ethereum, but we are blockchain agnostic. I think at the moment, Ethereum, there's a lot weighing on 2.0, Ethereum 2.0. It's, I think it's a big gamble, but if ETH2 pays off, I do believe that it can be the global supercomputer that it aims to be. I also think that they're the most realistic when it comes to decentralization. I didn't come into crypto because I thought everything needs to be decentralized, with my pitchfork and my torch, you know, ready to go to the Bank of England. But I've always believed since Libya that there needs to be a decentralized alternative. Living in England, and I lived in the US for a while, you hear these arguments and you think, is it really needed, you know, this decentralization? But then I heard that Gaddafi just turned the banks off one day. You know, people started protesting, just turned the banks off, all in the country. Not a single person had access to their savings. And that's when I had that light bulb. I was like, people need a decentralized option. And that's what I think Ethereum is very honest about. You know, we can't be 100% decentralized at the moment. If we want to, you know, have developers working on it, if we want to be still remain some control, if there's a bug, and you know, blockchain is a software, distributed ledger technology is a software. Software has bugs. I still think there is some control needed, but they're very realistic in terms of, you know, Vitalik is at least. You know, we may not be fully 100% decentralized at the moment, but that's the goal.
Yeah.
Whereas some people, you know, if someone says they're 100% decentralized at the moment, that's one of those alarm bells are going off.
Yeah.
Can you really be 100% decentralized at the moment?
Yeah.
You know, you've raised money, you're paying developers. How does that work?
Exactly. Couldn't agree more. So I think that's a really, really good spot in which to end the podcast today. I mean, Charles, thank you very much for coming on and sharing your insight. I think we could definitely do a follow-up one of these on, you know, maybe post ETH2. It'd be really good to see kind of where we end up in November, December this year. Any last words about yourself and Zero Carbon Energy, how people get in touch?
Yeah, find me on LinkedIn, Charles Adams, and the Zero Carbon Project. Thanks for having me. No, it feels like I just looked down. I thought it'd been about 5 minutes.
No, it goes quick. And if anyone out there, anyone of our audience might want to be on the show or appear, drop us an email to podcast@coinpass.com. Drop us a tweet @coinpassglobal. For one last time, I want to thank my guest Charles for being here today. And everyone, stay safe out there, and we'll see you next time.